Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Bradley Phillips.
Thank you, Brittany. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, and I'll be facilitating the call today. So during the call, we'll feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question-and-answer session. So as we go through the presentations, I definitely encourage you to download a copy of the presentation that our speakers will be following. And you can get that at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. And this is in the media advisory if you're looking for it. Our first presenter will be Jay Crouch, climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. We'll provide a summary of the October U.S. Climate Report and the Drought Monitor released earlier today. Our next presenter will be Jessica Spasio, a climatologist at the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University and also with NOAA's Northeast Regional Climate Center. We'll discuss recent record warmth in the Northeast and the impacts from a late October storm that occurred in the area. And the final presenter will be Stephen Baxter, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest La Nina update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks over the coming 3 months, which puts us through most of winter. First speaker today will be Jake from NOAA NCEI. Jake?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number two in the slide deck you can download. I'll be talking about the U.S. report that came out last week. The global information will be released publicly tomorrow morning, so I won't be talking about that today. Looking at what happened in the U.S. during October, it was a warmer and wetter than average month for the entire contiguous U.S. The average temperature for the lower 48 was 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average, while the precipitation total was 0.37 inches. The two maps show locations that were, or the map on the left shows locations that were warmer than average during October. Please pardon the map there. It says August. I will update that online momentarily. But looking at temperatures across the U.S. during October, much of the Southwest was warmer than average, as well as much of the East, with much above average temperatures across the Midwest, the Southeast, and then that record warmth that Jessica will speak about in the Northeast. We did see below average temperatures across a large area of the Northwest, the Northern Rockies, and into the Great Basin. Some of the cold temperatures that we saw in that part of the country, locations were top 10 cold, so a fairly cool October across the Northwest. Looking at precipitation during the month of October, we did see mixed totals. We did see below average precipitation across much of the Southwest, as well as the southern plains and lower Mississippi River Valley, where drought conditions have been developing recently. And we do see dryness across parts of the northern plains during the month. On the wet end of the spectrum, many locations from the Midwest stretching to the East Coast were wetter than average. Michigan did have its wettest October on record. And a lot of that precipitation in the east was associated with tropical systems. So the precipitation in the southeast was associated with Hurricane Nate. Hurricane Nate was the fourth hurricane to impact the U.S. this year. And then a lot of the precipitation in the northeast was associated with the remnants of Tropical Storm Philippe, which Jessica will also speak to. Moving on to slide number three to look at U.S. temperatures for the year to date. We're currently on pace to have our third warmest year on record. For the first, in looking at data just for the first 10 months of the year, only January through October of 2012 and 2016 were warmer than average, And this is the 21st consecutive year that we've had contiguous U.S. average temperatures above the 20th century average. The graphic on the left shows how those temperatures broke down during the month. And we see that a lot of the warmth spanned the nation from the west coast to the east coast, and only parts of the Pacific Northwest being cooler than average. We did see record warmth across parts of the south and east. Arizona, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina have each had their warmest year to date so far. Then the graphic on the right just shows how January through October temperatures have changed through time, beginning with our period of records start date in 1895. So we can see that we've been above average for 21 years now when we look at the entire contiguous U.S. Moving on to slide number 4 to look at precipitation for the year to date. We've had our second wettest January through October on record with a precipitation total that was 3.57 inches above average, and only the same period in 1998 has been wetter. It is unusual to have near-record wet and near-record warm conditions for the contiguous U.S. Our really warm years for the contiguous U.S. tend to be dry years, and it's kind of out of the norm to see a really warm year also be really wet. The map on the left shows January through October precipitation totals. We see a lot of wetness across the large areas of the U.S., particularly the west, parts of the Great Plains, Midwest, and Northeast. So it's been a fairly wet year for a lot of locations. On the dry side, we have seen dry conditions for the year to date across parts of the Southwest, as well as the Northern Rockies and the Northern Plains. And then the graphic on the right shows how year to date precipitation totals have changed through time, beginning with our period of record start date in 1895. And we see how 2017 is near the top of the pack in terms of contiguous U.S. precipitation totals. Moving on to look at the U.S. drought monitor that was released this morning, 13.1% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought, and this is down about 1.3 percentage points since the beginning of October. We did see drought improvement across the Northwest, as well as the Northern Rockies and parts of the Northern Plains, the Midwest, and the Northeast. So where we saw precipitation during October, we tended to see drought improve, and then we saw drought worsen across the Southwest, Southern Plains, stretching into the mid to lower Mississippi River Valley in the southeast. So those locations that missed out on precipitation in October tended to see drought conditions either intensify or develop. And then outside of the contiguous U.S., we have been dealing with drought conditions for the past couple of months in Hawaii, and beneficial rainfall recently has helped improve drought in that state. And with that, I will pass it off to Jessica.
Okay, thanks, Jake. So I'll be starting with slide number 6. So as Jake had talked about, it was warm, particularly in the Northeast in October. So the map here is showing the average temperature departure for the Northeast for October, and the entire Northeast was above normal, with the departures ranging from 2 to more than 8 degrees above normal. So it really was a warm month. And in fact, 6 states had their warmest October on record. That was Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Hampshire. And New Hampshire had the greatest departure with 7.9 degrees above normal. On to slide 7, the chart on the right is showing our 35 major climate sites, what their October temperatures were and what their departures were. You can see that 11 of them have been highlighted in yellow. Those had their warmest October on record. Departures for those sites ranged from 7.2 at Central Park to 10.5 degrees above normal at Burlington, Vermont. They had the largest departure for those stations in October. There was many daily records broken throughout the month, and particularly for warmest minimum temperatures. So then we're talking about the nighttime temperatures. And the graph there is showing two particular days that were very warm, October 8th and 9th. And again, we're talking about the nighttime temperatures here, where those departures range from 12 to 22 degrees above normal. So really large departures. During those 2 days alone, there were 51 minimum temperature records tied or broken. Also, during the month, there were 10 sites that had their warmest low temperature for October broken. So it had their record warmest low temperature at 10 sites this month. So it really was a record-breaking month for the Northeast. We switch on to slide 8. We'll switch over and talk about precipitation and the events at the end of the month. There was actually two. One ranged October 24th through 27th. That was mainly centered over New England. You can see precipitation amounts, the high amounts range from 3 to over 6 inches. The darkest green areas had the over 6-inch totals. The highest that we had recorded was 8.42 inches at a station in northern New Hampshire. So we had heavy rain and also being fall, the time of year went into play here. Storm drains got clogged by leaves, and that exacerbated the flooding that was seen. So roads were flooded, roads were impassable, cars were actually stuck in floodwaters, and some rivers reached their flood stage. There was also some wind associated with this event, high winds causing down trees, down power lines, and power outages. The highest gust that we have noted for that event was 52 miles per hour in the state of Maine. And if we flip to slide 9, the next event was October 29th through the 30th. So this was just a few days after that other event. So really, within a week, two big events that covered some of the same areas. And again, up to and over 6 inches of rain was recorded at certain locations in the Northeast. Again, that's noted on the map in the dark green shade. The highest amount noted for this event was 6.38 inches at a station in southern Vermont. There was a storm report of a house being carried away by floodwaters in New Hampshire, so there was a lot of rain associated with this. There was also some snow with this event in some of the higher elevations of West Virginia and Maryland. Up to 8 inches of snow fell. And the other major contributor to this storm was the winds. This was really a high wind event. Gusts of 70 to 80 miles per hour were common throughout the region. There was also the highest gust noted was in eastern Massachusetts of 93 miles per hour, so very windy. Nearly 1.5 million customers lost power during this event, which is a really high number. And of those, over 400,000 were Central Maine Power customers. That was the largest number of power outages in that company's history. That exceeded the 1998 ice storm, which had been kind of the benchmark storm prior to this for power outages. The state was in a state of emergency because of all of this. It's interesting to note that many trees were uprooted, and one thought is that the drought contributed to so many trees being easily uprooted. Roads have been closed for days in some areas, particularly Maine. It was hard hit. Emergency crews had a hard time getting to the streets to make repairs. And also along the coastal areas, boats were crashed along the coast, pulled loose, and the harbors were damaged as well. With all these power outages, many flights were delayed. Hundreds of schools were closed. So this was really a big event for the region. And with that, I will pass it over to Stephen.
Thanks, Jessica. I'm going to pick up here on slide 10, and we'll talk about the global sea surface temperature pattern that we've observed over the past month, as well as the current and forecast evolution of the El Niño Southern Oscillation. So in terms of sea surface temperatures, the figure on the upper left shows the below normal sea surface temperatures that were observed over the eastern Pacific, and these start off the west coast of South America, and these extend along the equator to right about the date line. This is a pretty nice La Niña-type pattern that was kind of fairly well forecasted in the past couple months, but if you have been following this going back several seasons, this kind of was a little bit of a surprise. 6 or 8 months ago, we were expecting actually look at the potential for El Niño, and what we ended up with here is quite different. The anomalously warm sea surface temperatures that you see in the West Pacific there, they kind of extend into the subtropical basins, both north and south of the equator. It's a very classic ENSO signature associated with the cold phase of ENSO, which we call La Niña. And so we're kind of underway here. We have a La Niña advisory was issued in the last ENSO diagnostic discussion. And so that does form a pretty important part of our seasonal forecast going forward. In terms of the ENSO forecast itself, these show probabilities for each of those three phases of ENSO, El Niño, Neutral, La Niña. And La Niña is forecast to persist through winter before ENSO Neutral becomes favored in spring and summer. Look, beyond this period, we do have some data, some forecast data that goes actually to the end of 2018. And at that point, the ENSO forecast is highly uncertain. So we don't really have a good feel. Sometimes if you're in a strong El Niño, for instance, sometimes we can get a pretty good feel if we're going to transition quickly to a La Niña in the following year. These kind of double or triple-dip La Niñas are pretty common, and we don't typically have a lot of predictability once we get beyond this current event. So So in terms of our monthly forecast for temperature precipitation for December, so it's a pretty challenging forecast, a very uncertain forecast. For December, we're kind of favoring above normal temperatures across much of the southern tier of the U.S., with below normal temperatures being favored for parts of the northwest, northern Rockies. That extends northwestward toward southeastern Alaska, including the Alaska Panhandle. And then above normal temperatures are again favored for the northwestern parts of mainland Alaska, where long-term trends are quite high. For the precipitation map, we favor below normal precipitation across much of the southern tier of the U.S., and we're starting to see this kind of classic La Nina pattern forecast with above normal precipitation favored across much of the northern U.S. And during December, the greatest odds of below and above normal precipitation, respectively, are over the southeast U.S. and then the northern Rockies. We're also starting to see the development of a La Nina-induced dipole of precipitation across Alaska, with above normal precipitation being favored for parts of the northwestern parts of mainland Alaska, and below normal precipitation being slightly favored across southern Alaska, as the north kind of the north coast of the Gulf of Alaska there. Moving on to slide 12, we'll talk about the seasonal forecast. This is for the winter season, the three-month season of December, January, February. Fairly similar to December forecast, because we have kind of a longer averaging period here looking at 3 months, our confidence is a little bit higher, so probabilities are a little bit higher. And this does reflect kind of a large-scale La Nina footprint as well as long-term trends. So we're favoring above normal temperatures again across much of the southern tier of the U.S., a very modest probability to extend northward along the eastern seaboard, favoring above normal temperatures as well. And then again, similar to December, we have below normal temperatures being favored across the northern tier of the U.S. This does nose kind of southeastward into parts of the northern plains and upper Mississippi Valley. And the forecast over Alaska looks very similar. Again, kind of this cold south, warm north and west being favored with fairly modest probabilities. It's during this season that the forecast precipitation map really takes on a distinct La Nina flavor, with below normal precipitation being favored across the southern tier of the CONUS, above normal temperatures being favored across the northern tier of the contiguous U.S., and then again that same kind of wet north-northwest Alaska with some modest probabilities favoring dry across the southern tier, southeast part of that state. Relative to last month, probabilities have been increased just a little bit along the west coast, with below normal probabilities creeping into parts of southern central California and above normal probabilities creeping into to cover most of the Pacific Northwest. The last slide I'll talk to here is slide 13 with our three-month drought outlook. And this is derived largely from the forecast precipitation patterns, but also with climatology in mind. And so you can see the ongoing drought regions are forecast to expand with drought development likely across the southern tier of the U.S. where below normal precipitation is being forecast. In areas where above normal precipitation is being forecast across the northern tier of the U.S., there are some areas where drought improvement or removal is likely. One interesting thing to note here is in the northern plains, in the northern high plains, it says drought persists, even though we're favoring above normal precipitation there. Given the climatologies there that are very low and that a high percentage of the precip falls in frozen form during the wintertime, drought improvement here wouldn't be likely until kind of beyond the actual core winter season as we get into the spring months when snowmelt and climatological precipitation amounts begin to increase. So that's just one little apparent inconsistency, but something that I wanted to note there. Also in the bottom, the inset panels there, there's Hawaii, we're favoring a drought improvement. Jake had mentioned that recently Hawaii has seen drought improvement. We're expecting that to continue. In fact, that's a very canonical La Nina footprint, is that you have dry conditions over the equatorial Pacific, but over Hawaii you actually have enhanced trades and you have enhanced precipitation during the winter season. That's expected to lead to drought removal and improvement across much of that state. Okay, I'll turn it back to Brady for the Q&A.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Operator, Brittany will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please remind them how they can ask a question and queue up the first question. Thank you.
We will now begin our question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone and unmute your line and record your name clearly when prompted. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. And our first question comes from Craig Miller.
Thank you. I'm just curious if you can speak to the strength of this La Nina, and given the historically weak correlation between La Nina and actual precipitation in California, what's the basis for your prediction of a below average precip for much of California over the next 3 months?
Hi, thanks. This is Steve from CPC. So good question. So in terms of the strength of the La Nina, right now something's being kind of targeting based on the latest numerical and statistical guidance. We're looking at something on the order of a week to possibly kind of borderline moderate La Nina for the winter season. Your discussions about the impacts over California are well noted. Again, this is a very subtle tilt in the probabilities here. We're talking about 33 to 40% chance of the upper, or rather the lower tercel verifying. But in terms of the objective basis for that, so there's a couple things we can look at. One are, we call them calibrated dynamical model probabilities. These account for the historical skill score of models over their hindcast periods, which go back to the early 1980s. And there's a lot of confidence from those inputs that a slight tilt toward below normal precipitation, rather, is appropriate in Southern California. And then more basically, coming out of the multi-year drought, a lot of the attribution studies that were done did, in fact, point to the role of the tropical Pacific as playing a small part, not the major, the dominant role, but a small part in kind of tilting the overall background state towards one favoring dry in California. And the current sea surface temperature pattern that we're observing across the tropical Pacific is one that's very much consistent with what those attribution studies found. So that's kind of the overall basis there. But yeah, you're quite right. In terms of looking at where the ENSO footprint's the strongest, it's certainly not over Southern California, so the probabilities are more modest there. But we do think there certainly is right now a reasonable objective basis for that forecast.
Okay, thanks. And we can take this offline if you like, so not to take up a lot of time. But I'm also curious about the definitions of atmospheric rivers. So I don't know, Brady, maybe you can point me to somebody who I can talk to about that.
Sure. Yep.
Okay, thank you all.
And our next question comes from Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News.
Hey, I got basically a two-part question here. First is, you know, given the 3 months of winter, do you see 1 month standing out either being more mild or more cold than the other two? You know, we've seen in past years, especially here in the Northeast, where we've kind of not had a winter in last February, and in previous years, December was quite warm. And then the second question is, how severe do you expect the drought to be across the southern U.S. by the end of the season?
Great questions. Thanks, Brian. This is Steve again. So I like your first question. It's something we don't kind of formally put out in our forecasts, although kind of internally we've talked about looking at this. So I'll kind of just give what I'll term as a little bit speculative, but in terms of the dynamical model guidance, there are a few of the dynamical model solutions, the European Center forecast being among them, that kind of point to maybe January being the colder of the 3 months. Now, we don't have a way of kind of incorporating that here. In terms of La Nina more broadly, and this is actually the opposite of El Nino, there is a small but potentially significant shift where early in the winter, in La Nina winter, you would favor a colder outcome, across parts of the Great Lakes in the Northeast, relative to February, which tend to have a slightly warmer outcome. Again, that's fairly subtle, but that is something that the data bears out to some extent. And so you'll kind of see this in the seasons. In fact, as you go out through our seasons from into JFM and FMA, they get a little bit warmer once you get into FMA, for instance, along the eastern seaboard. And it's a kind of a subtle reflection of that. So I hope that answers the question a little bit. It's something we're interested in. I will say another thing going forward. I mentioned the December forecast was pretty tricky. There was a lot of kind of conflicting shorter-term climate signals combined with the dynamical model forecast for December. And one of the things we look at for trying to time these issues, and what you're kind of alluding to, is even within a season, whether it be warm or whether it be relatively cool, we're going to have this intra-seasonal variability where some period of weeks is going to be much colder than others. We know that we experience this sub-seasonal variability. And one of the more predictable ways we try to monitor that is through the Madden-Julian Oscillation, the MJO. And just over the past day or two, there are some indications that the MJO might be heading into a phase toward the end of November and early December that might be favorable for a warmer outcome over parts of the east central part of the country in, you know, early to mid-December. And if that's the case, it kind of does give some room for what some of the dynamical guidance is saying, which is that if you get any kind of MJO propagation, then maybe you have a little bit of a pulse back toward the colder side heading toward the new year. So some of that's kind of speculation, but I just want to give you kind of a feel for some of the things that we're kind of looking at and trying to understand as we address that kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. And the drought severity?
Oh, the drought. Sorry. I thought there were two questions, and I got lost in my first answer. Sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, good question. So the drought development, by definition, what that means there is that there will be, for this to verify, it will mean that there will be a one-category drought development, which would be D1 drought. We don't have a forecast specifically on how many, you know, how bad the drought will be. In terms of how one might think about that problem, it's a combination of where is climatological precipitation the highest and kind of overlapping that with where the forecast precipitation deficits in a standardized sense are going to be the greatest. And that's something that we don't really flesh out right now at this time scale for this product. So officially the forecast is for D1 drought at least, could be more, but we don't really have a forecast for whether an area might be more likely to be in D2 or, you know, in a worser case, D3 or something like that. We don't really have that guidance right now.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Brandon Lee.
Hello.
Hello. Please ask your question.
Oh, okay. I have a couple of questions. First of all, with the previous question, I actually didn't have this question earlier, but with the previous question about the MJO, how high is the certainty level that the MJO is going to go into one of these warm phases with enough of an amplitude to really have a good effect on the weather pattern as opposed to staying in the north phase or even unexpectedly moving into a colder phase? Second question would be, if the NAO or the AO, the North Atlantic and Arctic oscillations, trend negative during December, could that override the weak signal you're getting from the tropics potentially and lead to a colder outcome? And third of all, what is the potential you see for a month like February of 2017 or December of 2015, where the entire East was just a total blowtorch? There were widespread locations that were more than 10 degrees above normal. In fact, they were one of the two warmest on record for the entire country. It was so warm. And in December 2015, every single state along the East Coast just smashed the previous December temperature record. It felt more like an October than a December. And I guess this question is probably for Jake Crouch talking about past month or for Stephen Baxter talking about future forecasts.
All right, so there are a lot to unpack there. I'll go through it quickly. So the first question with MJO, pretty speculative uncertainty, I would say, is high. So my confidence in that statement is, I would say, low to medium. So the latest dynamical forecasts for the medium range heading toward the end of the month do suggest a little bit of a shift towards convection in the Indian Ocean, Eastern Indian Ocean, Western Maritime Continent, which would be a little bit more favorable for warmer outcomes over the East Central U.S. Second question, AO and NAO variability, that's a good point. That was one of the uncertainties heading into our December forecast. And, yes, the initial state of the AO, NAO will have a role. So you can have this kind of constructive or destructive interference between that and a tropically forced signal. So that's a good point, and that's something that will certainly affect the outcome of the forecast. Okay, and then the third question, which I don't remember now. What's the third question?
Okay, the third question, and this might be for Jake Crouch to an extent as well, is in the past two windows, the East has had a month that was just extraordinarily warm. Like, it felt more like the middle of spring than winter. It was so warm. First in December 2015, going back 2 years, and then again in February 2017, going back 1 year, and there were just dozens of states that were record warm in both of those months. And December 2015 in particular, just the entire East obliterated this warmest December and record. And in fact, some states were actually having a cool year in 2015 before December. And just the month of December alone made it be a warm year. Now, no one in the East is having a cool year this year. But what is the chance you see of a just complete blowout hot month like that? And what do you think may have caused those months in the past two winters? How much is down to global warming? How much is down to the teleconnections and the El Nino that we had 2 years ago?
All right, thanks. So real quick, and then I'll let Jake jump in if he wants to, one kind of the historical perspective. So one of the things that those examples show is that the state of ENSO is not anywhere near sufficient for being the primary factor in those extreme events. Of course, December 2015 being a very strong El Nino, last winter being, at the time, kind of this weakish La Nina, not officially La Nina now in the current ENSO table. Those are largely driven by internal variability and sub-seasonal climate variability. Of course, in a warming climate, you're going to kind of shift the probabilities of those a little bit higher. And I'm not going to speculate on how much that shift is for a given month per se, but certainly that shift is present. In the case of El Nino alone, something like 2015, some of my work has shown that maybe on the order that kind of event's maybe three times more likely in Decembers where you have a strong El Nino. But that's, still very small chance of that happening with such an extreme event, but it does kind of push the distribution there a little bit.
But December 1997 was nothing like that at all. And
sure.
December 1997 had a very strong El Nino. December 1997 was very warm across the north, but like the southeast was not warm in December 1997.
Right. So you're right. I mean, so in the case of these distributions are being shifted by lots of different things, and El Nino is only one little shift there, and so there are a lot of possibilities that can unfold within the context of all El Nino events, for instance. And so I'm just saying that's one little part, but you're right. Things like North Pacific oscillation variability, the AONAO footprints, those are all very important.
Okay, we'll be moving on to the next question. Operator, can you remind people how to ask another question? Thanks.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone and unmute your line. Record your name clearly when prompted. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment as we wait for any additional questions. Our next question comes from Patricia Kitchen from Newsday.
Hi, thank you. Stephen, I'm with Newsday. We cover the Long Island section of New York, and it looks like this month is very similar, pretty much about the same as last month's, with a slight tilt to above normal for winter and then no real call for precipitation. I'm wondering, given that you know a little bit more about this, like weak to borderline moderate, and are there any further inklings that might sort of give hints as to what that part of that neck of the woods could be thinking of?
Thanks, Patricia. This is Steve. I'm tempted to give you my inklings, but they're not going to be very helpful. So in terms of precipitation, right, the northeast region, the I-95 corridor, if you will, is a little on the fence in terms of ENSO footprints. Mm. Perhaps traditionally we might be a little on the drier side during La Niñas. Combating that, however, is that longer-term trends are a little bit wetter in the northeast. And so those two factors are a little bit conflating here. So, for example, in El Nino winters, like a couple years ago, we may have had a slight tilt toward above normal precipitation, at least across parts of the mid-Atlantic coast, maybe up in the southeast New England, where those signals are a little more in agreement. So that's one of those two things are in agreement, so it creates a little bit of uncertainty there. So that's one. With respect to temperature, a lot of what's going to happen in the Northeast is going to depend a little bit on some of these internal patterns of variability, things like the North Atlantic Oscillation, things like the North Pacific Oscillation. Those are going to play a role in how much and the intensity of cold air outbreaks can really so during La Niña winters, that you're more confident there's going to be a reservoir of cold air in parts of Western Canada and the Northwest U.S., and that will kind of surge southeastward at times. But the mid-latitude pattern that's not entirely forced by the tropics, in fact, some of it might not have any tropical forcing at all, is going to play a role in how much of that comes east. So generally speaking, in a weak La Niña here, one of the things that you might notice if we look really carefully at these forecasts is that across parts of the Northeast, the forecast is pretty similar to long-term trends, and in some areas might be just a little bit cooler than the long-term trends.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where we're sitting right now.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, on week two or week three and four time frame, hopefully we'll have a little bit more to say about the variability across parts of the Northeast, where some of those patterns might be able to come into our kind of predictable focus.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Craig Miller from KQED.
Hi, thanks for giving me a second round. It was Jessica who mentioned this before, but she's a Northeastern specialist, and I don't know, I'm not sure who could take this, but she mentioned specifically that many daily records are broken for T minimums in the Northeast. Are you seeing that same pattern for California, and can we quantify that?
Hey, this is Jake. We do have at NCEI, we do have an online tool where you can search for daily maximum and daily minimum temperature records by state. I'm more than happy to send that to you or to help you look at the data there. So we do have the means to look at that and provide that specific numbers. In general, though, we over the past decade or so, we are seeing nighttime lows. Those records set in nighttime lows exceed the number of daytime warm records. So the nights tend to be warming a little bit faster than the days, and so we're seeing that show up in the daily records as well.
Okay, I'll circle back with you maybe on that data then. Thanks.
Yes.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please.
Operator, I think at this time we're going to close out the call. And I just want to finalize by just giving people a couple of reminders for some upcoming releases. First of all, the October global stats will be released tomorrow at 11 o'clock a.m. The November U.S. climate highlights will be released on December 6th. And then the November climate highlights will be released on December 18th. Finally, I did want to give a plug for the Explaining Extreme Events in 2016 from a climate perspective report, which will be published as a special supplement to the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. Will be released on December 13th at 11:30 a.m. at a press conference being held at the annual American Geophysical Union Conference, which will be in New Orleans this year. If you go onto the AGU website and look for press, they haven't updated it yet, but many of the press conferences will be web streamed. So if you're not going to New Orleans, you can look online. Just as a final reminder, an audio file of this call will be posted on NOAA.gov within 60 to 90 minutes or on the media advisory page. And if you have further informational needs, please email me, brady.phillips, that's brady.phillips at NOAA.gov. And this will conclude the call. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may all disconnect at this time.